You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's the time of year when broadcasters who have run out of ideas come up with the, oh, let's do a review of the year. And I'm going to start this year's reviews with the founder of ETM Macro Advisors in the Western Cape, and that's Russell Lamberti. And Russell, I would say, I mean, when I scribble down my notes, I say to myself, what's happened this year? Well, it's been characterized by desperately poor South African economic performance, a political paralysis rendering us mired in this sort of maelstrom of economic and social malaise. There's been Brexit, and the embarrassment of Brexit is now led by Boris the buffoon after that spectacular buffoonery that came before him. And of course, we had Mr. Trump and the US administration, which has so many stories associated to that individual and that administration, but also with a backdrop of record-breaking equity markets because, I think, mainly of the US Federal Reserve. Feel free to add in anything there that I've missed out upon, and even look at the short term, which has disturbed me in the last couple of days with the outflow of money from the South African bond market, which to me is probably the most significant event of the last few weeks. But anyway, anything I missed?
Gosh, Lindsay. Well, firstly, good to be with you.
Thank you.
I think I'm inherently terrible at remembering what happened in the last 12 months. But you jogged my memory there quite nicely, so I thank you for that. It seems like a year these days is a lifetime, and I suppose if we think about the year that's just been from a South African perspective, yes, I think it's been a terrible year economically. If we recall that in the first quarter of this year, Eskom couldn't keep the lights on. We had a dramatic rolling load shedding, and that caused GDP to slump considerably. We rebounded in the second quarter only because we kept the lights on, and that sort of caused some sort of stabilization. But what that meant was that H1 of 2019, the economy didn't grow at all. And H2, it looks like we're in for something fairly similar at this stage. The third quarter retail data and survey data from the retail sector looks absolutely terrible. And that... Those bad retail numbers and the negative surveys of retail sentiment seems to have in 2019 finally caught up with the share prices, which have taken a dramatic tumble through the course of this year, last year and into this year. So even stalwarts like ShopRite, which is, you know, this kind of big staples business, has come under huge pressure. As people start to realize that South Africa's retail economy is just under immense strain. Why is it under immense strain? Because productivity levels, that is to say production and growth from a productive perspective, is in the doldrums. And it's ultimately household productivity that affords them the income to create purchasing power that drives retail. And I think a lot of retailers have missed that fact. They've based a lot of their forecasts on population growth. They've had overly ambitious expectations of the growth of the middle class. But really, if you unpack it, South Africa's lack of productivity growth, which is underpinned by, you know, amongst other things, Eskom, which essentially constrains productivity growth in this country, that's now starting to really bite the retailers. In some ways, that would be, for me, the big macro story of 2019, that the retailers have finally started to capitulate, and this retail story has gotten extremely bad. So that's kind of the negative side from a domestic perspective.
Just on the retail side, and again, I'm a short-termist because I'm a broadcaster, but on the retail side, there does seem to have been some sort of stabilization. I mean, there are certain shares that have bounced back. For example, Woolworths, they came out with a trading update, and I know you're not in the business of having a look at these short-term moves, but their South African food sales growth over a 20-week period was plus 8.8%, and in-store inflation was 5.4%. So there is evidence that certain sectors of the South African community are doing well. But I mean, the big picture, as you quite rightly say, is pretty poor.
Yeah, it's bad, and I take your point. I think you're quite right. We have seen the likes of Woolworths bouncing back quite strongly. None of these things move in a straight line. It is likely in these sorts of big moves that things get oversold. We're not necessarily seeing a big cyclical retail sales crash, I think it's the realization, though, this year that we're in this pretty well entrenched sort of structural retail, either decline or perhaps stagnation, but certainly very little growth on the retail front, very little pricing power to the end consumer. So you know, this is ultimately the result of many years of production side failure starting to really manifest on the consumption side of the economy.
Yes, indeed. And that's all links back to one of my points in my introduction, and that is policy paralysis from the political environment in South Africa, because it just seems to me hits home when you look at the front page of bdlive.co.za this morning. It says here, Reserve Bank's gauge puts more pressure on Cyril Ramaphosa. The leading business cycle indicator fell an annual 1.6% in September, marking the 12th consecutive decline, alongside sliding business and consumer confidence levels. Obviously, not much news out there, so they say to themselves, well, let's have a dig at what is going on and try and stir up a bit of discussion, which they've done. But, if Ramaphosa was a football manager, for example, and I have to bring in a football analogy at some point in this, in this chat, he would be under pressure. We'd have Paddy Power and Ladbrokes and William Hill, the bookmakers, all saying, well, it's 1-2 Ramaphosa being the first manager to go. But, of course, that doesn't work in politics.
Yeah, well, I guess there is far less accountability in politics than there is in the rough and ready world of football managing. But I think it's a good analogy. I think that I was going to tack on to my sort of monologue on the retail sector, that really what we're seeing is the realization from the political side that all the hopes and dreams of what a Ramaphosa presidency might have meant are really starting to unravel a little bit, and I think it's just this realization that whatever policies or ideas you might want to put out there as being plausible or that you might propose, they've got to find traction in the real world. And I think what we're seeing is that the Ramaphosa administration is having a lot of difficulty translating ideas into real world traction. And that's because the real politic of the situation is incredibly challenging. We've mentioned it in a previous chat, so we don't have to go into all the details, but just to, as a very quick summary, the labor situation and the intransigence of the labor unions, as one example, makes any kind of significant, meaningful reform efforts kind of stillborn. So the bottom line is that we're seeing this now really manifesting in sentiment. People had hoped that Ramaphosa would be a huge improvement on the Zuma era, and of course, in some ways, that is indeed true. But there's not that traction that people expected, and I think that's what's really hit confidence in 2019. So the bottom line is that like a struggling football manager, the results need to follow quickly. And Ramaphosa, unfortunately, doesn't seem like he grasps the full extent of the urgency required. And if I may just say one thing, it was very disappointing to hear him 2 days ago saying things like the private sector needs to emulate the public sector.
Sorry to laugh.
In its degree of transformation, now what he's doing is he's focusing on race and racial criteria as a business and capital allocation mechanism, and he's comparing the so-called success of the public sector. Now this is incredibly worrying. The public sector is in a complete state of dysfunction and meltdown. And to now prioritize, race-based selection, to be intensified in the private sector, when what is desperately needed is just a keen focus on efficiency and on productivity, it just shows that he's kind of lost the plot when it comes to understanding what's really going wrong with SA. I mean, to suggest that the private sector should be more like the public sector in any way, shape, or form at this point is to be kind of delusional. And so I think that just fills one with a slight sense of dread that we are being led by someone who actually doesn't grasp the full extent of the problem.
Well, this is extraordinary, because I understand that there's a rock, there's a hard place, and in the middle is Cyril Ramaphosa, but I didn't see the comments that you've just referred to. But on the other hand, he made his billions from the private sector all those years ago. And dare I say this, and I'll probably get a Twitter storm against me, part of the reason that he made his billions was because of his race in the early days of black economic empowerment. I'm not saying he's not a good businessman, whatever, but in those days there were several key individuals whom we all know that profited from that. And therefore, to say that the public sector is a leader in this regard of economic and business reform is quite outrageous.
It's astonishing. I mean, the level of, you know, the lack of self-awareness is on a quite a unique level. And you know, there's been no hard evidence that Cyril Ramaphosa in his own right is a quote unquote good businessman. You know, that's been the sort of moniker that's been attached to him, but he absolutely has benefited from BEE deals, from being politically in the right place at the right time. He's certainly not incapable. I'm sure he's added value to, you know, in some of the contexts that he's been involved in. But he's certainly not a from the ground up entrepreneurial capitalist, by no means. And as you say, he's obtained this wealth and this largesse in a private sector context. So, look, I think it's worrying. This kind of talk is delusional talk, and it says to me that the ANC, even at the uppermost level, by one of its better leaders, is still basically living in the world of magical thinking and la la land, and that's concerning, and that's starting to be revealed. And investors are voting with their dollar, you know, on that basis.
Yes, but what we are going to get, of course, at the end of this year is certain asset managers coming to the party and saying, well, this year we thought it was going to happen at the beginning of the year, but it's going to happen at the beginning of 2020. There's lots of bargains out there, and we're happy with the progress, albeit slow progress, that Cyril Ramaphosa is making. And I can see all the presentations now to clients at the end of the year justifying poor performance and saying, well, doesn't matter. We've got a good base here, and onwards and upwards we go in 2020, which is a fantastic sentiment, and maybe they're going to be right. But they've been wrong for a couple of years now.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, as they say, a broken clock is right twice a day. I think there's a sense in which I think they will eventually be right. South Africa is unlikely to fall in a straight line and unlikely to underperform every single year against everyone else. So, you know, there will be periods, I think, where we do a little better if we can stabilize, at least stop the bleeding in some of our policy dysfunction here, you know, sort out one or two government departments, you know, get one or two things on track a little bit, maybe keep the lights on more sustainably than we have up until now, you know. That can create some kind of minimal uplift at the margin, and maybe one day these guys will be right, and South Africa does a little bit better than some peers overseas. I mean, you know, I think that's not that hard a sort of idea to sell, but up until now they've been wrong, and they, it smacks of them having to sell a story that they don't really believe in, but their business kind of hinges on it, and so they got to keep selling that story. And so I think the key really is not to wait for the broken clock to be correct twice a day, but to listen to analysis that's been more accurate over the years, you know. And I think that's a more sound basis on which to assess the future.
Undoubtedly, in the background, there are economic advisors to Mr. Ramaphosa and his team. If you were appointed one of those advisors, if you haven't been already and haven't told me, what would you be saying? What would be your quick fix for South Africa before we move to the overseas economy and markets and developments? What would you say to him? You've got three choices. What to do immediately?
Yeah, look, a good and challenging question. I think that I would say leave the Reserve Bank as is, hands off. That's working. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I think the SARB is being pretty well managed, and I think we've got to hold the line there. The fiscal situation has to be tackled with immediate urgency, and the equation is quite simple. You balance the budget. You spend what you earn in tax. You need to do that quickly. A beeline for a balanced budget would create an immense amount of confidence in the government and in this economy. Yes, it will entail some pain. Yes, you got to cut fat, but there's a lot of fat to cut. And you know, yes, you'll disappoint some people, but you won't disappoint everyone. You can still keep most of the spending intact. So you just got to balance the budget, and you got to make spending. You got to rein in spending. So I think those would be the big things. Once you've done that, you actually have some space to cut taxes. We are drowning in taxes is the private sector in this economy, and that really is a huge issue. So I think fiscal reform, immediate fiscal reform, is key. And then finally, you know, I spoke about it earlier, but this complete obsession with racial criteria in business and BEE and so-called racial transformation and so on, we've just got to back off that and adopt a more free market, rational approach. The country is made up of, you know, 80 to 90% Black South Africans. They will automatically be absorbed into the economy and will benefit from a growing pie. So we've got to stop that obsession, because the race obsession in BEE and affirmative action and so on, I think, is a huge issue. Unfortunately, Ramaphosa keeps banging that drum. So we've got to back off from that. We've got to actually lighten the load of BEE scoring and transformation targets and so on, and just focus on getting the job done, lightening the tax load, and getting efficient again. So those are the sorts of things I would address immediately, and I don't think that they're that far out of reach. They get sort of billed as these unreachable sort of goals, but these are things that can be achieved quite quickly.
Yes, indeed. I mean, one of the things I would say, if I was your advisor advising him, I'd say, just whisper in his ear that he has a political monopoly. He's not going to get sacked in the morning. He's not going to have an election in 6 months' time, so he doesn't have to appeal to the so-called ANC rump of supporters. He doesn't have to do that. He's just going to say, this is what we're doing. We're in power for all these years, and explain it in some way. Obviously, it's not going to go down well with the unions, for example, but just do it. You have a better opportunity than most politicians, apart from Kim Jong-un and President Xi, in the world to implement your policies. Just implement them, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think the problem is of course an ideological one, and that is that, you know, I don't think he necessarily wants to implement these kinds of reforms. But you're absolutely right. And this is actually the great irony of this whole situation, is that with every year that passes, the ANC's electoral majority becomes more tenuous and less certain. And that actually makes meaningful reform at the margin ever more difficult. When you're running at a roughly two-thirds majority or 60% of the vote plus, you can make big changes. And there's been a huge amount of goodwill and popular support for the ANC. And if these changes quickly bear fruit in growth-enhancing outcomes, which they would, you would get tremendous goodwill at the next election, which is still, you know, 4 or 5 years away. So, you know, there's all the political capital that they need, and you know, the unions are actually becoming an ever less relevant constituency as a voting bloc. It's very small. And as a political force, the unions are actually in a lot of trouble. They don't have a lot of popular support. They've got no proven electoral mandate. So Ramaphosa really, it's time to act. And I think the fact that he's dragging his heels is testament to some of the hard rail politic beneath the surface. And I suppose that's where the unions are, in fact, where they do wield their power, is that they can hold certain processes to ransom, like at Eskom. You know, I mean, they can sabotage Eskom and really bring this economy to its knees. So I get it. That's where the sort of rail politic of the situation happens. But you rightly point out that the mandate is there and it's not being acted upon.
No, it's not. Let's move overseas now. Let's focus on just one thing, because we don't have time to go into Hong Kong and other markets. But New Zealand, for example, one of the best performing stock markets in the world, very, very quietly. But let's have a look at the United States of America, S&P, Dow Jones, Nasdaq, benefiting from a liberal policy on the price of money from the US Federal Reserve and also tax cuts from Donald J. Trump. So everybody is saying that Mr. Trump is absolutely fantastic for the markets. But we don't want to talk about politics or Trump, otherwise we'll get into another argument. But he has done well for the wealthy, hasn't he?
Well, look, I mean, like I said in our previous discussion on this, Trump is a mixed bag. And I think what he's given the market in taxes, he's taking away in the form of future taxes by running an absolutely absurdly large deficit. The U.S. deficit will run this year at close to $1 trillion, probably reach $1 trillion in 2020. Well, all you're doing is you're storing up the need to raise revenues in the future to pay down these huge debts. So you know, he's crowing about the wonderful impact of his tax cuts. I don't think he's thinking this through properly. These deficits are really absurd. And I think that's storing up real problems. You know, yes, this US market continues to run higher. It's pretty, you know, it's done a lot year to date, but let's not forget that that's because of, it's off a low base, because December 2018 was a brutal month in the markets. And so we finished out 2018, you know, quite well down. So a lot of the rebound is just kind of reclaiming some of that lost ground. Obviously, in the last few weeks, the market has really pushed on higher. And it's this continuation of a very long bull market. And I think people have to, you know, in terms of assessing when this might end, we've got to look at, I think, some of the underlying features that have allowed this to sustain for so long. And one of those features, one of those core features, is that CPI inflation has remained relatively low. And as long as inflation is low, you're in this kind of Goldilocks sort of world where your long duration assets like long bonds and from an equity perspective, a lot of your tech stocks, you know, continue to do fairly well. And that's kind of a continuation of a lot of what we've seen. So, you know, the game continues for now, but I do have my concerns about the sustainability of a cycle that's based on incredibly low interest rates and very, very high deficit spending by the Trump administration.
Yes, I mean, the analogy I've always used, I'm quite good at analogies, if not economic analysis. I would say that when a volcano starts to erupt, it gives you a little bit of a warning, sends out a few rocks and spews out some gas, and then it gets a little bit more serious, like it was in December 2018, which was an interesting month, because I think the S&P in that month, because I'm quite good with numbers, it was down 9.9%. Then it recovered again, and there's been a couple of other wobbles, but there have been warning signs from the volcano that is the nascent bear market, if you like. But as the bull market gets more and more elevated, then of course the bear market is going to be spectacular, certainly in nominal terms. And I just wonder what the catalyst is going to be. It was certainly not from the Fed, which is continuing to pump 60 to 80 billion into the market and to the primary dealers, and they then can lend it to the companies that they then buy back their own shares. And then there's these deals between Novartis and another medicines company of 9.8 billion US dollars, and Tiffany's being bought for 16.2 or whatever the figure was, billion, for a little jeweler on Fifth Avenue. I mean, these numbers are outrageous. And that's one thing I have to ask you in commenting upon my last comments, is what does this mean in the economic cycle when people start buying stuff because there's cheap money and their stock is so high?
Yeah, look, I think that question to it kind of makes, you know, it makes the point, I think, very eloquently. So, I don't even know that I need to add too much to it. I think what you're hitting on is a very relevant issue, which is that, and I guess we're learning how long and how high these bull markets can extend when they're based on a fountain of cheap money, and you get all these sort of leveraged share buybacks and all sorts of other means and mechanisms of financial engineering going on. M&A activity tends to be very buoyant. And look, these are classic late cycle, you know, extreme bull market signals. And, you know, we don't know when it's going to end. No one's got a crystal ball on this. And I guess that's, you know, part of what we do for our clients is to, you know, continue to monitor the best indicators and the best kind of leading indicators and data on this stuff. And I mean, you know, to speak to that specifically, our indicators have been saying, you know, it's not the time to bail just yet. The macro situation in the US is kind of holding up. the market indicators, yes, the market's overvalued, but you know, the internals in the market, the risk-taking sentiment in the market seems to still be there. So we haven't actually been advising big short positions and big underweight positions on the S&P, even though we think it's a very stretched cycle. And I guess it's all about understanding that you're in this prolonged, you know, excessive bull market, but also understanding that these irrationally exuberant and liquidity-driven, low interest rate-driven bull markets can last longer than you think, and they can go a lot higher than you think. And we probably need to see more capitulation by the bears, like you see in typical, you know, extreme cycles before things truly well and truly turn around. So, you know, it's about being extremely vigilant and understanding the season that you're in and then understanding the sort of short-term weather patterns. We're clearly in a more bullish short-term weather pattern.
We're not allowed to talk about weather. Actually, I must tell everybody that I was going to talk about climate change to Russell Lamberti, who is the founder of ETM Macro Advisors. And if you look at his Twitter feed, he says he's not afraid of CO2. But I'm not going to get into that, because otherwise we'll be here until the new year. But just to reiterate what you've just said, is the M&A activity that has been concentrated in the last few days in spectacular fashion, is it a late cycle phenomenon because of what I said, the expensive stock that can be used and because of the cheap money?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot to that. What you get in these sorts of portions of the cycle is that sometimes doing an M&A deal is a lot more attractive than doing a brand new greenfield type investment. You can buy an existing story. You can sell it as with good business speak, like leveraging efficiencies and all this sort of stuff. And you know, if you can fund it on incredibly cheap debt, which is still available in you know, just about all of the Western world. Yes, there's a sort of an internal logic to these things, and there is pretty good empirical evidence that large M&A cycles tend to be late cycle signals. Now, we have seen lots of M&A for a number of years, and the cycle has continued. So there's a sense in which, you know, this is a little bit of a you know, an ongoing story where this high M&A level hasn't quite yet predicted the recession, but it does, I think, give you a sense of this prolonged kind of activity that happens on these very low interest rates. Now, maybe this goes on for another couple of years and it becomes officially the longest expansion upward phase of the business cycle in American history. That's certainly plausible, but we also know that every long bull market is followed by a pretty brutal bear market. And so that's coming. It's in the post. It's just about understanding, you know, getting the timing right and really trying to read the best quality signals that one can from the data and from information, rather than, you know, trying to stick your finger up into the air and see which way the wind's blowing, but really grapple with good information and good leading indicators. And I guess that's what we try and do, and we try and help our clients understand the lay of that land.
Let me just read you something. Collecting the most important results of about 80 empirical merger studies, this study condenses the bewildering spectrum of results to 18 stylized facts, which obviously we don't have time to go into. It says here, though, most important, no more than a quarter of mergers increase consumer welfare, another quarter increase profits at the cost of consumers, half of the mergers reduce the value of the firm, targets shareholders win, while bidders' shareholders break even upon the announcement of a merger but lose significantly in the long run. And it goes on from there. So again, that sort of suggests like that disastrous giant media merger, which was, I think, a textbook disastrous media merger. And I can't remember what it was. But anyway, you know what I mean. If these things happen because everyone gets a little bit too effusive and a little bit too ebullient, these things fail. 2020, from your point of view, more of the same but with an element of caution?
Yeah, it does look like more of the same. I'm not seeing at this stage, not seeing obvious, you know, acutely bearish cyclical signals out of the US. And I guess as long as America, as long as the American engine keeps chugging along, you know, reasonably okay, you kind of can't get too bearish, you know, everywhere else. China remains a huge thorn in the side of the global economy. It is struggling to recover from its 2019 slowdown. Stimulus efforts in China, I think, are struggling to find traction. And that, you know, that is weighing down. So it is a bit of a two-speed global economy. And if you add them together and divide by two, where you've got a slowing China and a U.S. economy that's kind of keeping its head above water, you're sort of in a situation where it's just this fairly mediocre growth world. So that's not going to be fantastic for stocks. It's hard to see global equities doing very well in this kind of environment. And if you look at it, you know, the U.S. market that's kind of surged ahead again in the last few weeks, is a little bit out there on its own. It's not really being followed, you know, that closely by the FTSE or by European stocks or by South African stocks. So this is a little bit of a U.S. story. You know, let's see. I think for now we look at continuation theme. No obvious big signals that this bull market's about to end. And in fact, if this U.S. market continues to perform like it does, it's going to engender, you know, more confidence in emerging markets. Some of these outflows that you're talking about from South Africa's bond market, you know, might actually return, maybe not into bonds but into equities. EM. You know, inflows, I think, could pick up. I think we're already seeing some early signs of that. We're seeing some signs of European inflows. So it could just be apocalypse, you know, delayed at this point. And I think that's probably the theme we need to go into 2020 with.
Russell, thanks so much for your analysis today and also for your contributions throughout 2019. Russell Lamberti is the founder of ETM Macro Advisors based in the Western Cape. That podcast was proudly brought to you in association with sharenet.co.za. Visit strictlybusinesspodcast.com and subscribe to receive exclusive content straight to your inbox.